What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 133, and today we're going to be taking a deep dive into how stress affects your heart, and honestly, how a stressful life leads to heart disease. I know that sounds kind of crazy. Everyone thinks heart disease is caused by fat, caused by steak, caused by cholesterol, but we're going to go into some real hard science that shows otherwise, or at least that shows that stress is a very, very big player in having a heart attack. And we've already talked about stress and the resulting cortisol, like release, causing visceral fat to increase. And visceral fat is a clear marker for heart health. And that's just fat that's around our organs. Subcutaneous fat is under our skin. Visceral fat is around our organs. Basically, the more you have, the less healthy you are. Visceral fat is recognized as a major risk factor for heart disease. But if you want to learn more about that and how stress makes you fat, literally just search stress makes you fat on the website and you'll find a whole podcast on it. But today we're going to be talking about something and stress in a little different light, right?
Yeah, so today we're going to kind of compare and contrast how our bodies respond and adapt to psychological stress, like, you know, mental stress, driving through traffic, and physical stress, like, you know, working out, going on a long bike ride, you know, playing sports, something like that. And why psychological stress leads to heart disease, where physical stress does not. So we'll just kind of compare and contrast.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't distinguish the two. Like, stress is really just one box you tick. Nobody really thinks about working out as stressful compared to, you know, not being able to pay your mortgage type of stressful. And basically, just the top level, what this podcast will be about is going to be exposure to various stressors, no matter what they are from a psychological standpoint, causes HPA axis dysfunction, which leads to abnormal cortisol levels, and then heart disease is created. And it's precisely in that order. And to touch on what the HPA axis is, I'll just go through what's going on in our brain when a stressful situation occurs. So you get release of stress hormones, and that's controlled by the hypothalamus and pituitary glands acting in unison. So under a stressful situation, for example, a man pointing a gun at you, the hypothalamus sends an alarm message to the pituitary gland, which then fires off hormonal messages to the adrenal glands to get them to release adrenaline and cortisol, among other things. And this cascade is often referred to as the HPA axis, H standing for hypothalamus, P for pituitary, A for adrenals. And dysfunctional HPA axis leads to heart disease. And HPA axis dysfunction can come in the form of elevated cortisol levels, but it can also come in the form of an abnormal cortisol response. It's basically a blunted response to stress. Normally there's a peak of cortisol, then it levels out, it kind of drops down. Just like all hormones in our body, there's peaks and valleys. No hormone is designed to stay elevated for extended periods of time. And that explains why some people who complain of chronic stress get their blood cortisol levels checked and they come back normal or slightly elevated when they would expect them to come through the roof. These people have been chronically stressed for so long, they no longer have a proper response to stress. And diseases that result in HPA axis dysfunction in the form of elevated cortisol is something usually referred to as Cushing disease. That's a disease where your cortisol is through the roof no matter what. And people with Cushing's disease have accelerated plaque growth and a significantly increased risk of heart disease. And something else that causes HPA axis dysfunction in the form of abnormal cortisol response is depression. it is known that people with depression are at a greatly increased risk of heart disease, and it has been studied, and in depression, you always find HPA axis abnormalities. So this HPA axis is key to what's going on with heart disease. It's just, it's been shown in various different mechanisms, and those are just a few of examples right there that show heart disease can be caused by stress and the hormonal response associated with it.
Yeah, that was a great explanation of everything. So let's just kind of point out a few like interesting observations that are going to kind of back up that stress does indeed cause heart disease or heart attacks. So these facts come from heart.org. Usually this is not a go-to resource, but for something like this, I feel like they can be reliable. So the Monday after daylight savings in spring, that's right after you lose an hour of sleep over the weekend, you know, all that extra stress that's going to come from your body not being able to recover as much because you've lost an hour of sleep. So that Monday after daylight savings, you have the increased risk of a heart attack by 24%. Just to compare that, the Tuesday after daylight savings in the fall where you gain that hour of sleep, it decreases the risk of having a heart attack by 21%. And we're looking at the Tuesday after daylight savings because Mondays typically do have more heart attacks than any other day of the week.
Yeah, I think those numbers are huge. And those numbers are known. Like, it's not hard. You just Google heart.org and you'll find these statistics. And I think a question has to be asked, why don't more doctors preach stress management as a means to decrease heart disease risk? And I thought about it, and I thought about really, how do you measure stress, especially in a controlled, clinical, repeatable way? Because without this measurement, traditional medicine loses interest real quick, because it's really hard to sell a pill for something you can't even measure. And remember, doctors get maybe 5 minutes with a patient. It's quick and easy to read a blood report and tell you your cholesterol is high, but it's much harder to sit down and have a real conversation with someone to gauge their unique stress level. So I think that's a part of it. The system's not designed to deal with figuring out how someone is stressed.
Well, and every stress management technique that I know is either free or damn near free. Like, hey, lay on your back, focus on your breathing. And hey, guess what? If you fail at meditating that way and you end up taking a nap, that's pretty good at relieving stress too, and that doesn't cost anything. Taking like a nice warm bath, hey, that's pretty much free other than like that little slight raise in your water bill. I mean, come on. Like, these are basically free techniques. That's why they're not preaching them, because nobody's making money.
Yeah, it's sad, man, but that's true.
So a couple more observations, and a lot of this information is going to come from the Great Cholesterol Myth by Dr. Steven Sinatra and Johnny Bowden. So that's the main source of material for most of this podcast. So the most common day for having a fatal heart attack is Monday. The second most is Saturday. So for some people, going to work is a major stressor. And for other people, it's going home and dealing with that family life that's a major stressor. That's why those 2 days are number one and number two. And one more observation before we really start getting into like the nuts and bolts of this podcast. The men in Rosetta, Pennsylvania, have a strange protection from heart disease. Men 55 to 64 have almost no heart attacks, and men over 65 are at only half the average risk. Men 55 to 64 is not a low risk category. That's a pretty high category for men to have heart attacks.
For sure, yeah.
So I know what you're thinking. These guys must be wealthy, must be like living a good life, have a good, healthy lifestyle, everything like that. Well, unless you consider working in an underground slate mine, smoking cigarettes, and eating a highly processed Americanized version of their traditional Italian food, living the good life and a healthy lifestyle, yeah, very far from what you would think. So, yeah, I mean, that's not the ideal situation. They're working underground, so they're not getting lots of fresh air, not getting the vitamin D or the benefits of the sun, not getting any clean air from smoking cigarettes all the time, and definitely not eating a healthy diet.
Yeah, but you would think these people would be dying of heart disease and heart attacks literally left and right, but they're not, which shows there's another angle to this.
Yeah, from everything I just said, these guys should be dropping like flies, not immune to heart disease. Mm-hmm. And they're not dying from something else either.
Yeah, so that's actually a good point. Yeah, that's a real good point.
Oh, they don't die from heart disease because they die from...
We're all dying of cancer. Yeah, exactly.
So almost every household contains three generations of family members. So the older members of a household are treated as like village elders are still involved in the community. So they're not living isolated lives in a retirement home. Instead, they're still living at home, taking care of the grandchildren. There is like, you know, elders giving people advice on how to do everything, cooking food. They're still living a pretty active lifestyle. And even though the diet isn't the best, they're eating large family meals at a large table filled with a big family. So they're eating with other people, taking advantage of that. Festivals are a regular occurrence. People are involved in church, social clubs, or both. So everybody at every age is involved in the community and they have a clear and valuable role. So essentially, the people in Risotto live a highly social and connected life that minimizes many of the chronic mental stressors that affect most Americans. So they're not isolated. They're not worried about, oh, do people like me or anything? Because, hey, they have all this family around them. And that family, those wise elders, are able to direct them on what's going on. Since they do have such a big family, they're able to talk about a lot of personal issues to get that stuff off their chest. They don't have a lot of those stressors just kind of building up. So that's the believed reason that these men are protected from heart disease, despite all the red flags that we just discussed.
And really, what you just reading that and talking about that just reminds me of the lockdown we've had for over a year now, basically puts the bulk of the world in the exact opposite of that, in complete isolation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only good thing to come out of the lockdown is like Zoom. So people aren't 100% isolated. But yeah, I've been against the lockdown for that very reason.
Yeah, like we're social creatures. We're designed to be around each other, especially the people like our friends and family. I mean, it's just, it's crazy to tell everyone to stay apart for this long.
Yeah, like you're not only telling people to stay away from people, but you're also telling people to like fear other people because they might give you a fatal disease. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a horrible combination.
Yep.
But that's a whole nother podcast.
It is a whole nother podcast, yeah.
So I know what you're thinking. Does that mean it's okay to smoke cigarettes if you balance them out with family dinners? I mean, that's definitely not what I would recommend, but it does seem like there is a little bit of evidence to support that. Okay, but those are all observations. We talk all the time about how observations only give you so much information. They're helpful, but they're not the whole story. So let's take a deeper look at what's going on inside the bodies and look at some mechanisms to explain these observations. So when we get stressed, we activate our sympathetic nervous system. So that's our fight or flight response. So in that time, we divert blood to our muscles and away from our digestive organs, away from our sex hormones, and we're just focused on producing two main hormones, like Tyson said earlier, adrenaline and cortisol. Adrenaline instantly raises your heart rate and blood pressure to deliver more oxygen and nutrients to your working muscles. So, hey, your legs, your arms, whatever you're going to need in a fight, like that's where all your blood's going. So if you work out all the time, you've taken advantage of this all the time. So have you ever felt a pump? That's because adrenaline is directing more blood to the organ that's actually being used. Adrenaline is what you could think for that pump that you feel. Cortisol, it causes your liver to release glucose into your bloodstream so your working muscles have more fuel. So it's a great mechanism. So you got more blood, you got more oxygen, and now you got a lot more quick, easy fuel to burn. So this is all about keeping you alive for the next few minutes. Your body's not repairing anything. The immune system is taking a break. Digestion is shut down. Reproduction is an afterthought because none of that matters if you don't survive past the next few minutes from this stress. This is a very old system and works amazingly well. We and pretty much every other animal on this planet would not be here today if this system didn't work. So the problem is that this system is designed to work against physical stressors and not mental stressors. And here is the problem. Most of the stress we have today is mental and not physical. So let's just kind of compare and contrast physical stress versus mental stress. So during physical stress, adrenaline increases your heart rate and blood pressure. However, blood flows more easily from your muscles. However, blood flows more easily from your muscles to your heart because your muscles are contracting and working as a pump to help blood flow back through. This is known as a skeletal muscle pump. So this is especially true for venous return coming from your legs, because that blood is very far from your heart and has to work against gravity. So if you're running away from a predator or chasing down some prey, your legs are definitely going to be working. All that contraction is pumping blood all the way back to your heart. So that's a good thing. It's helping with that blood flow. Also, after you break down muscle, your body will build it back bigger, faster, stronger to better adapt to this stressor in the future. Everybody that works out knows this and takes advantage of this process all the time. And that's also going to, that bigger, faster, stronger muscle is going to further increase the skeletal muscle pump's abilities. So again, this will take away some of the burden from your heart to keep up with the demand for a high cardiac output.
But the thing is, most people are never in that situation anymore, like a physical stressor. I mean, honestly, it's a blessing and a curse, because a physical stressor in today's world would be like the example I said earlier, someone pointing a gun to your head. Nobody wants that. So that's a blessing. But the curse is that the type of stress we do have, our body's very poorly designed to handle it.
Yeah, that's true. And generally, like, a physical stressor is really short-lived, because you either chase down your prey, you fail to, you escape from the predator, or unfortunately, maybe you die. So, I mean, like, that effect isn't going to be very long. But that's what we're supposed to do in response to adrenaline. But unfortunately, like you said, that's not how most people deal with it. So let's kind of look at the impact adrenaline has on, like, a mental stress. So, hey, let's say you're driving to work and you're running late because there is a car accident in front of you and traffic is just a mess. So your body is stressed, so adrenaline gets released, and your heart rate and blood pressure go through the roof. But now you're just sitting down for the next 90 minutes. You moving your foot from the brake to the gas back to the brake again is not enough to take advantage of that skeletal muscle pump, like something like sprinting would be. So your heart has to work even harder because it's not getting help from that skeletal muscle pump to get more venous return from your feet all the way back to your heart. And this type of stress lasts a lot longer. You're stressed the entire drive to work after you park your car and you have to run to your office. And then throughout the day while you're waiting for your boss to finally talk to you about being late, and then even after that conversation, you're still going to be stressed. Physical stress lasts for a few minutes, but mental stress can last for hours, maybe even the entire day. Like, that's one of the biggest differences right there.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said in the intro, our body is designed to really produce and utilize hormones in like a peak-valley system. Like, it peaks, your body uses it, then it dips down back to normal. To have it elevated for that long is going to come with some consequences. It's going to break the system.
Yeah, that's true. And also, I should mention that you can break the system through physical stress as well. I mean, most people don't have to worry about this. I mean, that's typically going to be coming from your, like, ultra-endurance athletes, like ultra runners, bikers, triathletes, something like that, because they work out for 2-3 hours every single day, like, you know, just never giving their body a chance to rest or relax. So you can get burnout that way. It's pretty much just called overtraining. That's one reason I do 2 long workouts a week, and then the rest of the week I give my body pretty much a lot of time to recover. So it's not just mental stress that can lead to it. But, I mean, it's pretty rare for most people for physical stress to do it.
Yeah, you have to be someone like you, honestly. But there's not that many ultra runners out there.
No, but a lot of people that do this type of, like, crazy workouts, they do it wrong. And they're running 10 miles every single day. So, yeah, there's a lot of people out there. So, one more interesting thing about adrenaline. I didn't put this in the show notes because I didn't really know where I put it. But adrenaline is, like, the only hormone that you can overdose on. Like, your body can actually overproduce it and kind of, like, accidentally commit suicide that way. The time that it will happen, like, you could literally get scared to death, that you get so scared that you produce so much adrenaline that you overdose on it.
Wow.
So it's called voodoo death. And the example that they gave in the book, The Great Cholesterol Myth, is, let's say, like, you know, back in olden times, hunter-gatherer, you pick fruit from, like, a sacred area. So now, like, all the village people that you're with are telling you, hey, the gods are angry and they're going to like kill you. So they now you're isolated because none of your villagers want to be with you, and you're just waiting for the gods to like come and get you. So all that added stress mixed with the isolation, you're eventually going to produce too much adrenaline and you're just going to die. You're going to have a sudden cardiac death.
Wow, I never heard of that.
Yeah, there's a very like short part of that in the book, but yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I don't know where to tie that in with the notes.
Oh yeah, no, I wouldn't know either, but that is very interesting. I'm glad you said that, though. That's cool to know.
Yeah, and I also wanted your reaction in real time.
Yeah, that's crazy. Because, I mean, the stuff our body produces, our body obviously knows what to do with it. You know, produces it for a reason. We've been evolved for millions of years. But I guess, in my opinion, that shows just how potent adrenaline is.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of these hormones we can overproduce and cause damage. But adrenaline is the only one that will, like, cause serious damage in the short term.
Yeah,
like, crazy. You know, producing too much cortisol, that takes a long time for it to actually cause damage. Same with, like, insulin, same with most of these other hormones. But adrenaline, nope, too much of that instantly can be fatal.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah. All right, so done with adrenaline, let's start looking at some cortisol. So, again, during physical stress, cortisol is your best friend. It gives you extra fuel in the form of glucose that can be used quickly, giving you that extra boost of energy that you may need. And we just talked about how physical stress promotes like muscle growth. This is especially important when it comes to our body's response to cortisol. So muscle operates on a use it or lose it principle. It is energetically expensive tissue. So unless you are constantly using it, then unfortunately you will lose it. I mean, this is one of the main reasons we always promote strength training, especially for older individuals, because you don't want to lose muscle.
And honestly, people think, you know, you train for a few years, you're going to have this muscle forever. But if you lay in bed for a week or two, you will visibly lose muscle. And I've seen it happen to me. I've had points in my life where I've had injuries and I haven't been able to train. I haven't been able to barely walk around for a few weeks, a few months. And I look in the mirror and I'm a different person. So it just takes a few weeks of inactivity to start losing muscle.
Yeah, that's a great point. And muscles are extremely important when it comes to cortisol, mostly because of the like all the glucose that gets released as a result of that cortisol, because Tyson likes to say this all the time, muscles are a glucose sink. Having more muscle increases your glucose tolerance because you have extra space to store it. So it's perfect if you produce a lot of cortisol, you produce a lot of glucose, or you release a lot of glucose, you don't use it all. Now you don't just have elevated blood glucose. All that glucose has somewhere to go.
Yep, that's a key point. That's another benefit of having muscle no one ever really talks about.
Yep, exactly. But if you're dealing with mental stress, you're not really using up that glucose. So that's why people get fidgety or pace around when they're stressed, because they just have too much energy and don't know what to do with it. And since you're not using your muscles, they're going to be full of glucose. You're not going to be depleting any of your muscle glycogen. If you're just sitting in your car or just pacing around, that's not really enough to release that glucose. So this means that your blood glucose has nowhere to go once the stress is over, and it's going to remain elevated for a very, very long time. And we talked about earlier how mental stressors seem to last longer. Well, if cortisol is elevated, you're going to keep releasing that glucose from your liver. You're going to keep releasing it. So your body's going to have more blood glucose, and it's going to have nowhere to go. So it's just kind of like a bad combo on both fronts. The result of chronically high cortisol, which over time results in abnormal cortisol response and high blood sugar, and this really causes a lot of damage to the arteries.
Yeah, and that's really the driver behind this cortisol causing heart disease kind of hypothesis. Is we're looking at it from the response to injury hypothesis for heart disease. And this hypothesis talks about just plaque buildup in a response to an injury, and specifically to the delicate lining of our arteries. It's literally one cell thick. And this is in opposition with a diet heart hypothesis, which blames LDL for heart disease. If you're looking at stress from the LDL hypothesis, none of this data makes sense because you can't correlate the two. But the response to injury hypothesis does not need LDL to make it work. And also explains why a significant proportion of people who suffer heart attacks do not have raised LDL. Actually, the majority have normal or lower LDL values. So blaming LDL for heart disease is just wrong on so many levels, and we've talked about it a million times, but do not worry about your LDL levels. If it was some potent killer, if it was such a prominent driver of heart disease, our body would have kicked it out and stopped producing it and turned off those genes millions of years ago.
And it wouldn't be like one of the top two killers in our country anymore, because we figured out how to lower LDL pretty good.
Sure did, yeah.
We're experts at doing that, but we're not experts at preventing heart disease.
Yeah, so obviously LDL is not the driving factor. It's not even a player, in my opinion.
All right, so we just talked about stress. So now we have elevated heart rate. That means our blood is going faster. Elevated blood pressure. So that means it's pressing against our arteries even harder. And now we also have heightened blood sugar. So we have a lot of damaging things pushing very hard at a very, very fast rate in our arteries. So this is going to lead to damage. Like, I mean, of course it is. Like, why wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So our bodies respond to this damage by forming plaque.
And hold on, and real quick, just to put, so people can visualize this, most arteries in our body that actually develop plaque, they develop it at the curves of the artery. So we're not like the arteries in a straight line. You might develop some plaque there, but when the blood takes these hard right angles, it creates a vortex of all this damaging shit in the blood, and that's where these injuries usually occur. You get all this sugar in the blood and all these constricted blood vessels. It just makes those corners really, I guess, tight. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if you're pushing a bunch of like bowling balls down like a zigzag alley or a zigzag like hallway.
Yeah.
Like where the bowling balls hit the wall.
The corners.
That's where, yeah, mm-hmm. the curves and stuff.
Yeah.
That's where the damage is going to be occurring. If it was just a straight hallway, there really wouldn't be a lot of damage.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good example.
So our bodies respond to this damage by forming plaque. And eventually, once enough plaque builds up, it'll harden the arteries. And hardened arteries don't vasodilate like they should. Instead, they remain narrower. So vasodilate means expand and get wider. So narrow arteries are going to increase your blood pressure even more. And if they're starting to build up plaque, that means that there's less and less space for blood to flow through. And another response to stress that we have not yet discussed is the production of platelets. Since our stress response is designed to protect us from life or death situations, those come with a high risk of losing blood. So there's also a mechanism to protect us from that. Like, our bodies produce platelets in response to stress hormones in order to form clots, just in case we do get cut while we're, you know, running away from a tiger or while we're hunting down a zebra or something like that. So remember, our heart rate and blood pressure are already elevated, and this is being directed to our peripheral muscles where we're most likely to get cut. So the potential for a lot of blood loss is very, very high. Aren't our bodies amazing that they're trying to, like, protect us in so many different ways? That's something I never even knew about.
You know, I knew about, because obviously we've done podcasts on cortisol in the past. We know how damaging just the normal day-to-day life it can be just to our bodies from a stressful point. But I never thought about from an evolutionary standpoint that I should have, because we talk about that with diet all the time. But, of course, our body would develop, like, a antidote to the poison. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So cool.
So it's like, yeah, if your heart rate's high and your blood pressure's high and you get a cut where you're flowing a bunch of blood to, yeah, you could bleed out really quick. So, yeah, let's make your blood a little bit thicker so that doesn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's not like through the bulk of our evolution we could, run to a counter and get some Band-Aids. We just wouldn't have access to that stuff to stop bleeding quickly like we do today.
Yeah, I don't know how long blood transfusions have been around for, but I'm willing to bet it hasn't been that long. I don't think our hunter-gatherer ancestors knew about that.
No, definitely not. And like Tom says, so those platelets and raised blood clotting factors are directly and consistently associated with an increased risk of heart disease. So they 100% play a factor, and cortisol causes those to be increased.
One adaptation to exercise that I don't think we've discussed before has to do with sweating. So in order for our bodies to cool ourselves during exercise, we sweat. So this water has to come from somewhere. And one of those places, it's not the first place, it's one of like the last resort places, is we start losing a little bit of plasma, that's basically the water, in our blood. So adapt to this, our bodies will have more water in our blood, aka plasma. So that way we can lose some of that water through sweat and still have enough blood to deliver oxygen and nutrients to our working muscles. So one thing you can do is you can, if you're like an endurance athlete and you want to take advantage of this, you can just sit in the sauna for a little bit, you know, sweat that way, turn the heater on in your car. There's a lot of ways you can just do heat exposure to make you a little bit of a better athlete. And that's also why saunas do have a positive impact on preventing heart disease, is just because your blood becomes a little bit thinner that way.
Yeah, we've talked about in the past, it sounds stupid to be honest, but being a good sweater, and this is basically what we're talking about, exercise and doing these things consistently over years, you literally become a good sweater. I know people think that's just like everyone sweats the same, but that's not true. If you get an untrained person and have them run 100 miles, they're going to have some consequences for a 100 reasons, really. But one of them is going to be because they're not a good sweater. But someone like Tom or someone like me or anyone out there who's exercised for years, our body knows what to do in that situation.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about this. I'm not sure if it's been on the podcast or not, but you got it from Tim Noakes' book, Waterlog, is that the best athletes when it comes to marathons are the ones who can deal with dehydration the best.
Yep.
And that has a lot to do with this right here. Is how much water can you lose from your blood plasma and still be able to keep going?
Exactly.
Because once you hit a certain percent loss in your blood plasma, you're starting to really like notice a dip in performance. But if you're able to adapt to that heat and become a more efficient sweater, like you just talked about, like losing that water isn't going to impact you as much.
No, actually losing that water is beneficial for those people who actually are very adapted to that process. And before Gatorade got involved, well, we've talked about doing a podcast on this, but this shit's actually really complicated. But before Gatorade got involved, every marathon runner who actually won, and even like the top five, they all had the saltiest blood because they lost the most fluids. So technically, they were the most dehydrated, but it increased their performance. They all won. So it's kind of counterintuitive to what most people will tell you, especially, like I said, since Gatorade and just sports medicine got involved in marathon running, they've kind of promoted drink literally as much water as possible, but that's not necessary to actually perform well.
And it's because of this phenomenon, like with becoming a more efficient sweater and storing more blood plasma, that some endurance athletes can appear to be anemic due to this. It's called exercise-induced anemia. It's generally not a concern. The only time it's really a concern is if it actually covers up real anemia, which is a lot more common in female athletes than male athletes. So just because like you get a test and it shows that you have a low red blood cell count, well, if you're a highly active individual, it's most likely not going to be a concern. If you are constantly exercising and sweating, your body will have thinner blood. So this extra platelet production should not be much of an issue. However, if you're that person sitting in traffic and not sweating, then this platelet production is very, very bad.
And just real quick, most of human evolution, everyone would be in that first group as far as constantly exercising and sweating, right?
Yeah, I don't think they had air conditioning back in the day. They lived outside all the time. Even if you weren't like hunting, you were walking, you were tracking prey, you were building tools, you were constantly doing stuff, and I'm pretty sure you would just sweat almost all summer long.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like you would be exposed to a lot of heat. And yeah, you would be a much more efficient sweater than most people today.
Exactly. So that extra platelet production and those like blood clotting factors, they weren't a problem for the bulk of our evolution. But when Tom said you get stressed and you're sitting in a car and the vast majority of people have a sedentary lifestyle, no matter what their job is, that's when all this stuff really is a problem.
Yeah. So these platelets will be overproduced and begin sticking together. So platelets can stick to red blood cells and white blood cells and a protein called fibrin to form a clot in the artery. This, if it gets big enough, this clot is called a thrombus. So if this thrombus gets large enough and then clogs an artery, then you have a heart attack. So yes, we're just showing you all these different ways, all these different steps that stress leads to heart attacks.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, obviously me and Tom are very pro on, like I've already said, an ancestral diet, which is low carb, nutrient dense food. We're all about that, you know, getting your proteins, getting your fat, all essential amino acids, all essential fatty acids. But what we're talking about actually has nothing to do with diet. This is a whole other angle of health that a lot of people actually neglect. And that, like Tom said, that thrombus production, that thrombus creation, that's basically, you could think of it like repeated insult, repeated injury to the same spot. Just think you have a cut on your arm, you cut it, a scab forms, and you cut it again. Scab form, cut it again. That's exactly what's going on. And that's how you find that protein fibrin, which is a key component of blood clots, in distinct layers within plaques. Like, plaques are little layers stacked on top of each other, almost like a, what is, it's paper mache, right? Where you stick paper on top of each other. Is that it? What is paper mache?
I don't know, man. You just threw a random curveball at me.
What's that shit? You know, when you were a kid and you do like newspaper and you'd put like glue in between it and you'd make things out of like the newspaper, it'd become hard. What's that called? Where you have to stack paper on top of it.
I mean, sure.
You know what I'm talking about, right? Okay, whatever.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I just don't know. Man, last week you asked me a question that I haven't thought of in like 15 years. Now you're asking me what I haven't thought of in like 25 years.
Yeah, my bad. I should have actually thought of that before, but I never thought of it till now. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about layers stacked on top of each other. And that's also how you find blood clots at different ages within the same plaque. And this is really just evidence to support that response to injury hypothesis, because the diet heart hypothesis that is commonly promoted by the AHA, which tells you to don't eat eggs, it tells you don't eat red meat, they can't explain those plaque formations. But if you believe what we do, there was an injury response theory that actually explains what's going on in plaque.
So to kind of just like put all this together, so when you're dealing with mental stress, you increase your blood pressure, you increase your heart rate, you increase cortisol, which increases your blood sugar. The combination of all that damages your arterial walls. Damaged arterial walls no longer vasodilate, so they remain narrow. And all of this increases platelets, thickens your blood, and eventually this will lead to a heart attack. With physical stress, you don't get damaged from the elevated blood pressure and heart rate and blood sugar, because you're using that blood sugar and can store whatever remaining sugar is there. And your blood doesn't get too thick because you have adapted to having thinner blood in response to constantly sweating. So none of this stuff is an issue if you're sprinting every single time you get stressed. If your stress response is due to you being in the gym and bench pressing, deadlifting, squatting, something like that. So if you are working out and dealing with physical stressors, not an issue. If you're dealing with stress and just sitting there and not doing anything, then it becomes a major issue.
A major issue, yeah. And there have been not a lot of studies, but a few studies looking at psychological stress and heart disease. They're out there. And one of them is called the Inter-Heart Study, and they measure psychological stress as one of their factors. And this is their conclusion. So they concluded that persistent severe stress makes 2.5 times more likely that an individual will have a heart attack compared with someone who is not stressed. So that's a huge, huge increase, 2.5 times. And we talked about earlier, it may be hard to describe to doctors how stressed you are or even get them to care since there's not really blood tests for it. But recently there has been a test that can show HPA axis abnormalities, and that's called the dexamethasone corticotropin releasing hormone test. So you might see it as DEX over CRH in like a form. So if you get that test, it can show HPA axis abnormalities, and you can use that to kind of have hard evidence that your HPA axis is dysfunctional, and you can kind of take that from there. And honestly, I don't know what the point of that is. It just, some people wouldn't want blood work to prove things, because the result is going to be, if you do have a dysfunctional HPA axis, is like those things Tom said earlier, take a bath, read a book, go for a walk. It's going to be all of those things just to de-stress. I think that's such a simple answer, people don't really believe it, you know?
Yeah, I feel like everybody's always looking for either just like, what is modern medicine? What does modern science tell us? We're so smart now, we should be able to put all these solutions in a pill. Or, no, that's too easy. Since it's so easy, it's not going to have a big impact. I need to do something harder. It's like, no, a lot of these simple answers and very easy answers are the right thing to do.
Yeah, just relax. Like, that's really going to be the solution. And just to finish and to quick summarize how stress leads to heart disease in 5 easy steps is how it works. Step 1 would be an unhealthy stressor. Like we've talked about for the last half hour, that would be like a chronic psychological stress or something like Cushing's disease, which results in chronically elevated cortisol production. Step 2, that leads to HPA axis dysfunction. Step 3, that results in abnormal or raised cortisol levels chronically. Step 4, factors that damage the lining of our arteries, like high blood sugar, paired with factors that increase blood clotting, like which happens with a raised cortisol. And then step 5 is plaque growth and eventual heart disease. That's what's going on. And we showed a few examples of when people statistically have more heart attacks, like Mondays and Saturdays. And just to talk about that real quick, it's not that that particular stressor was so extreme. And this is in most cases. Sometimes, like Tom said, adrenaline can kill you. But in most cases, that's not going to happen. Usually, it's that event being triggered by stress that happens over and over again over years. Slowly building up plaque in your arteries, making them stiffer and less malleable. So that Monday morning you wake up stressed to go to work, it sets off that cascade of increased blood sugar and increased clotting factors. This causes a plaque formation, which was already hanging on by a thread, to finally give away and burst free, causing a blockage of your artery and a heart attack. Really, if you think about it, it's death by a thousand cuts. Unfortunately, it's only the last cut that we feel. You never feel the buildup. You only feel it until it's actually blown out. And that's what's going on with heart disease and stress.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, the time you might know that you really have this buildup going on is when it's too late.
Yeah, and I've said this before, and I know it sounds kind of weird, but I really wish high blood sugar was painful, because then a lot of people would understand situations they put their bodies in are causing damage. Because there's a lot of people walking around blood sugars in the 200s and the 300s that feel fine and have no clue the type of damage that they're doing.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, because we talked a lot about, like, evolutionary, like, adaptations today. Like, this would... that scenario where you have chronically high blood sugar all the time would have never happened to our ancestors. So that's probably why we don't feel it, is because, like, there was never a need up until, you know, the last 100 years for that to happen. That scenario never existed.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. And I think about another thing is we've talked about how, like, bad high omega-6 diets are, linoleic acid, how they're oxidized, they become rancid. We don't even have taste buds for that because we weren't exposed to that amount of linoleic acid through our evolution. Even though if we were today, if we understood how bad it was today and we tasted it, we would know the shit we were eating was rancid, but we don't have taste buds for it. So it's kind of that same vein, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I hope you guys learned something. Just understand that stress really does kill. I know people talk about that in vague terms, but this is the literal, like, mechanism of action. This is what's going on in our body when you are stressed. So take the necessary steps to de-stress your life if you can. It is very important. And I know it's harder for some than others, but try your best.
And, yeah, we just talked about at the beginning of the podcast, those people in Roseto, like, Pennsylvania, having a stress-free life can help you overcome having a shitty diet, you know, working in a dangerous environment, smoking cigarettes all the time. It can help you overcome some of those things too. That just kind of really shows you how, like, powerful stress can be.
Yep, exactly. It's a huge factor, and it should be addressed in every well-formulated meal plan or any well-formulated diet. Stress should be part of that. But okay, that's another podcast in the books. Thank you for listening. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, so feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast provider. That's Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and YouTube. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.